Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad when you're here with us. And if you'd like to take part in our conversation on the exchange, you're more than welcome to do so. Phone number here, 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Take a look at two charts side by side, and the planet Earth tells us a story. One chart is the average temperature and shows a steady rise. The other chart is carbon in the atmosphere, and it shows a sharp rise. So it stands to reason that some of the efforts aimed at curbing the effects of global warming focus on changing some of the dynamics in the atmosphere. We'll discuss those at length for the balance of the hour. Today's guest will present his work at an upcoming meeting of Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, or SOCAN. The meeting is Tuesday, January 27th at 6 at the library in Medford. But Kevin Downing, the consulting geologist and the guest speaker, is our guest here today on the Jefferson Exchange. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. Give us a little bit about your background, about yourself, and what you've been doing over the years.
Yes, actually, this is something that I want to make quite clear, is that I am not an expert on climate change matters or an expert on geoengineering processes. I'm a geologist. I've worked in the exploration industry for minerals, gold, precious metals, and base metals for all of my career. And that work has taken me through various parts of the world, mostly in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, where I've seen basically the clamor for people to basically, they want electricity, and they want to get electricity in a fairly cheap way. And what I've come to think with all my work as a geologist traveling around underdeveloped parts of the world is that there are a large number of people on this planet already addicted to carbon, and that is us and the West, and then there are a large number of people who would like to become addicted to carbon, and that is the dilemma that humanity finds itself. And that is what's brought me to actually doing some study into how we can live with this addiction, and that's basically the basis of the work I've been doing with this. But I am not an expert on any of the topics that we're really going to be discussing today.
But you have researched them, you say, so you have some idea of the basic mechanisms involved.
Yes, I have. Yes.
For you in particular, was there any doubt? I mean, I guess I always try to sound people out, try to figure out when you can remember, if you can remember, being convinced that, yes, this is a problem. This is something that needs attention from the whole human race.
I would say I've been thinking along these lines for 10 to 15 years. I have been looking at the science one way or the other, the people that think that climate change is happening, and then the deniers. About 2 years ago, I actually read a book by another exploration geologist called Ian Plimmer. He's an Australian who wrote a book basically claiming that climate change was a figment. And it's actually made for quite compelling reading until you actually then looked at the quote. You know, he quoted a lot of peer-reviewed scientific data, which, you know, as a scientist, most of my opinions are based on peer-reviewed data rather than just anything that you can find on the internet. I believe peer-reviewed data is the only source for true scientific information. And this guy, Dr. Plimmer, Ian Plimmer, actually referred to peer-reviewed data. So I was quite moved by his book until I then read the rebuttals of scientists that he quoted, saying, no, that's not what we said, and no, those data points are in the wrong place. And then I realized that, okay, you know, there are people who are out there that will bend the data to fit their view. And, again, as a scientist, I know that that does happen, and it's something that we really need to be very cognizant of when we read something. We need to know who has reviewed this information and does it pass muster.
As you read material from people who doubt climate change, does it appear that they have a particular reason to doubt climate change, a particular motivation or reward that they get for not joining that that club?
I think basically it's driven by people who want to continue business as usual, and you know want to keep heading forwards in what you know appears to be the good system of capitalism in on the earth, and how we're you know improving the lot of man. And want to carry on blindly doing so, doing the same thing.
We have gotten to where there are a number of scientists who seem to be saying that it's late in the game. It's getting very late to effect changes to reverse things back to what we know as Earth in our time. You pointed out several times you're not an expert on atmospheric science, but do you have any particular opinions you've formed yourself from what you've read?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Do you believe it is getting very late to affect change?
Well, yes, it is, and you know, and that's basically the reason that I've started looking into the idea of geo or climate engineering, in that to my matter, and to my thinking, is that you know even if the agreements that President Obama and the Chinese president signed last year came into effect, it would have no significant effect on stopping the problems that we are going to be heading towards with the increase of energy that there is in the Earth's atmospheric system.
Hang on a second. We'll come back from a break and pick it up on the other side. Kevin Downing's our guest. He's a consulting geologist and involved generally in exploration for minerals based in Wairika. He'll come back and talk more about what he's learned about geoengineering as we talk about ways to approach climate change. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Kevin Downing and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about climate change and possible actions to stall, if not in fact reverse, what's going on in the atmosphere. Our guest is Kevin Downing. He's an exploration geologist based in Wairika. Points out that he is not an atmospheric scientist, but he will be sharing what he knows and has learned about efforts at geoengineering at a meeting of SOCAN, Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, Tuesday, January 27th at 6 at the Medford Library. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the processes now. 800-838-3760 throughout the region. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Dr. Downing, given that some people want to continue business as usual, when we talk about the things that exist in our world technologically and economically, from what you've researched, do you think technology is already in existence to reverse climate change without massive economic dislocation?
There are inklings of processes of systems that can be used. They need more research and they need a lot of discussion, because they are, you know, what we're looking at is processes that can be enacted by, you know, a fairly small community, but will have a global effect. And the global effects are not clearly defined yet. I would say that all the scientists that seem to be working in the field are clamoring for more research to be done. And I think really what we need to be doing is funding this research, or getting it funded somehow, and having a discussion in a wide public forum rather than it being, you know, kind of small backroom discussions that seem to be happening at the moment. Most people that I've talked to about this subject don't really know anything about it, even though they've heard of global warming and know there's an issue with climate change. They haven't heard anything about the possible geoengineering processes that might help, and I stress might help, get us out of the situation. I'm not saying that we have silver bullets ready to go.
You had talked about wanting to make sure that when you do your own research that you rely upon peer-reviewed work rather than just something you can pluck from the internet. In your opinion, is the internet part of the issue with climate change? I mean, does it perpetuate and allow people to gain a platform for speaking out against climate change and just giving the doubters essentially equal footing with everybody else?
I haven't really thought of it that way, but yes, I can see that that is a good point. Most peer-reviewed journals do not have glossy websites, whereas there are some other ones out there that look pretty convincing and are not based on any real scientific data.
Maybe we need to have it be one of those things on the internet where it says, like, you know, 10 ways Kim Kardashian can save the planet. People seem to click on those quite a bit. So the methods we'll be talking about today and that you're going to be talking about with this SOCAN meeting on January 27th are generally grouped under the heading geoengineering, which can be a freighted term, I'm sure you know.
Yes. And basically geoengineering forms into two forms, and you know, what I see is the approach that we have to take, humanity has to take with the problem that we have, is actually threefold: two geoengineering and one socioeconomic. The socioeconomic one is that we have to reduce our use of fossil fuels. What we're doing is digging up carbon that was sequestered, you know, 300 million years ago, and putting it back into the atmosphere. We have to stop doing that. The two geoengineering techniques are carbon dioxide removal, and SRM, solar radiation management. Carbon dioxide removal will actually simulate and copy geological processes that actually happen, have happened in the past and will continue to happen even once humanity is gone on the planet. And the Earth has been hot before and has had high carbon dioxide concentrations before, and it has changed and it has recovered from those situations and cooled down. But that process has taken millions of years when you look at it in the geological record. And humanity does not have millions of years to do that. So we have to accelerate those processes. And there are technologies out there that maybe can do that job. But even then, once we do with carbon dioxide removal, those processes are going to take decades, if not centuries, to actually remove some of the anthropogenic carbon dioxide that we've put into the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution. A more instant and emotive subject is SRM, solar radiation management, which is something that the technologies are out there and possible to go, but they can, you know, that there are potential of side effects and which we need to study and discuss, and we don't want to wait on discussing these techniques until some climate disaster occurs that suddenly brings the whole world into the idea of saying, oh, we have a problem, we've got to fix it now. We need to have done the research and discussed all these methods before we get to the point where we really say we must deploy this. It needs to be a well-considered thing. Man has tried technological fixes to issues on the planet before and has made serious mistakes in the past. And this one would be as dangerous a mistake as he could possibly make, fooling with the climate if he doesn't know what he's doing.
It seemed with the whole moment you just talked about when we getting to a point of saying, oh, we've got a problem, we need to do something about it. Do you think we haven't gotten there yet?
I don't think that the majority of the population of the planet think that we've got there yet. There's no clamor to say, you know, we have an issue, we've got to do something about it now. As far as I can see, you know, people are quite happy to continue with business as usual at the moment. I actually believe that we do have a problem and we have started some irreversible things, but I don't think it's sunk in yet to the majority of the population.
I want to come back into your strong suit, since you are a geologist, because I think a lot of us at first don't really quite understand what has been happening. We understand that the burning of fossil fuels releases carbon into the air, but the point is that the carbon was sequestered in the ground for eons. And so this is, first of all, did you ever work for an energy company, either coal or oil or gas?
I actually worked for an oil company for 1 year in my youth. In the North Sea of Europe, didn't like it. Got out of it quite quickly.
Yeah, because of the harsh environment, or because of the social implications.
Actually, because I'm a geologist that likes to stomp around in the bush and pound on rocks and go to places and look at things. And in the oil business, being as your target tends to be, you know, a minimum of 5,000 feet below the surface. Doing surface geological work isn't really important in the oil business.
I can imagine. Kevin Downing is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's an exploration geologist based in Wairika. And we are talking about climate change, which he admits as a geologist, his atmospheric science is not his strong suit, but he's done some research on it and will be presenting things he's found at the meeting of the Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, Tuesday, January 27th at 6 at the Medford Library. We have time to ask some questions and get some comments in here now. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Back to the very term of geoengineering I referred to as freighted, because it has been used several times by people who call into the program because they're convinced that the atmosphere and the climate are already being changed by planes flying overhead. Do you have any evidence of that yourself?
No, I don't. And, you know, and I have been to, you know, some of the websites and actually been to some meetings where this subject is discussed. And one thing that all of these people fail to do is to mention the geoengineering that we are definitely carrying out, which is the introduction of all this excess carbon and methane into the atmosphere. I mean, we are geoengineering the climate already, you know, without thinking about, you know, other processes that conspiracy theorists are talking about. You know, it is happening, but it's through carbon dioxide and methane introduction to the atmosphere. That's the geoengineering that we are doing in a completely uncontrolled manner.
I know that we have talked to the folks at 350.org and a couple of other organizations over the years about shooting for that goal of trying to get carbon to hold at 350 parts per million. We're well over 400 now. Is it going up a little faster than even you might have expected from what you've read?
Yes. I mean, it is going up really rapidly, and it's because, you know, I mean, carbon energy is cheap because we don't pay for the garbage that comes out of the coal-fired power plants. And you know, as long as it keeps on being that way, cheap, you know, people and developing countries are going to use it to power their development. Mozambique at the moment is opening up some world-class coal deposits. They are blessed with a huge supply of coal, which is only because of, you know, the politics and the wars in that part of the world for quite a few years has never been developed. It is now being developed, and, you know, we have so much coal that we can certainly fry ourselves quickly if we just pay for the cost of extracting it and burning it as without paying for the cost of cleaning it up.
So let's talk then about the methods that you talked about in turn. Two general categories under the overall term geoengineering: carbon dioxide removal, or CDR, and solar radiation management, or SRM. It seems like within each of these, there are many different types of processes that are under discussion. Are any of them perfected or at least being demonstrated yet?
As far as I know, none of them are actually in process. Well, CDR techniques are in process. In Norway, they are actually capturing carbon flue gas out of power generation plants there and reinjecting that into North Sea oil fields to actually pump out more oil, recover oil from old-aged oil reservoirs that are running out of life. They're using captured carbon dioxide to pump that oil out. And that's actually one economic way how CDR can be used, in that it can be used to remove to take more oil out of oil fields. And so there's actually, when we look at these techniques, we've got to think of, there's always cost benefit analyses that have to go with them. And I can see a case because we do not have alternate, a good alternate set of energy producing technologies in our toolbox at the moment. We're going to be using oil and gas, for longer, I hope, than we're going to be using coal. We should be able to rule out coal fairly quickly, I would hope. Or at least we could do carbon capture at the flue of all the coal power plants, because people aren't burning coal in their hearths anymore, in their houses. So coal is all mostly used in central large operations. So capturing carbon dioxide at the flue of a coal-fired power plant is much easier than trying to suck it out of the atmosphere, although both processes are things that we are going to need to do, because we even if we stopped using any carbon at all right now, we've still got a legacy in our atmosphere that we're going to have to live with, that we have to get out of there to stop us boiling ourselves.
All right. So the point is that carbon capture is a whole lot easier when you go to the source where the carbon is actually being emitted. That makes a lot more sense. Just in general, I mean, are some of the techniques that that look at carbon capture and storage or carbon dioxide removal generally, is it a somewhat easy process chemically, given that carbon dioxide tends to be heavier than what's around it?
It seems to be a process that can be done. I haven't looked in detail into the technologies that you would need to do to put it together, but coming out of flue gases, where carbon dioxide levels are high, is obviously going to be easier than taking out of the atmosphere when we're talking about 400 ppm carbon dioxide to be removed from much lower concentrations. So the processes are fairly well understood. Say, like one of the processes for taking carbon dioxide out of the general atmosphere is accelerating the weathering of rocks. And olivine is a silicate mineral, which is very common, especially in the northwest here, where we have lots of basaltic rocks. That if you accelerate the weathering of olivine, the chemistry is that you can it removes carbon dioxide and turns it into carbonate minerals. So these processes are well established in the chemistry, in the theory of them. The extent, I'm not sure yet. I haven't completed reading on the extent of how much of the say accelerated weathering you'd have to do, how large an area you're going to have to spread your crushed olivine around, and to accelerate the process, how much energy you're going to have to put into that. These are still questions that need to be answered, to my mind. Scientists out there might have it answered yet, but it's not I haven't found it yet.
That was a big question in my mind, too, was that if you're talking about technology that addresses things going on in the atmosphere on potentially a massive scale, you're talking about at least some expenditure of energy, which then creates some issues depending on how you create that energy, whether you or release the energy, whether you're for burning coal or oil or getting it from solar or some other renewable resource.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, basically all our energy sources are suspect, you know, because, say, you know, building nuclear power plants where you, okay, the actual production of energy inside the plant is carbon free, but then, you know, the massive amounts of concrete that you build, you know, concrete is a very carbon dioxide expensive material, and so all of these issues have plus points. All of these techniques have pluses and minuses, and it's those that we really need to understand. I'm not claiming that I understand them yet, and I want more understanding of the pluses and minuses of the techniques.
Much more to talk about. Kevin Downing is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is an exploration geologist. He's done some reading on carbon dioxide removal, CDR, and solar radiation management, or SRM. Collectively under the heading geoengineering, we'll talk more about these with you and Kevin when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the atmosphere and how to reverse or at least stall the effects of global warming, if that is possible, through the process of geoengineering. Two major processes, carbon dioxide removal and solar radiation management. We're talking about these with Kevin Downing. He's an exploration geologist, has done a lot of work looking for precious minerals in the earth. Stipulates he is not an atmospheric scientist, but will be presenting findings of his own research to a meeting of SOCAN, Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, Tuesday, January 27th at 6 at the library in Medford. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. That number works anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Pam and Dexter, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, and thanks for waiting.
Hi. Well, I'm not a big fan of talking about geoengineering with climate change because it kind of reminds me of cancer treatment. Like, let's talk about preventing cancer or preventing more carbon dioxide from being released rather than how to get it out after it's released, especially when there's a lot of questions about all the applications and, you know, it's kind of like the world is a guinea pig and who knows what the side effects of all this geoengineering would be. And I just think that we should really push educating people, because there's still a huge amount of people that don't believe it's happening. Last night, 350 Eugene had a demonstration outside the federal building to urge Obama to veto the Keystone XL pipeline as well as the Jordan Cove LNG pipeline. And I can't tell you how many people came by screaming at us, giving us the finger. I mean, it was just absolutely ridiculous that people are mad at us for trying to help save our biosphere. So I'm a big fan of a carbon tax that also is a pollution tax that would include things like clear-cut logging, and so we would promote sustainable thinning because our forests, and especially in Western Oregon, are one of the top 10 carbon sequestering forests in the world. So to me, we got to stop digging the hole that makes things worse and then, you know, see how much we can use the low-hanging fruit. I mean, there's so many things. We should subsidize clean energy systems. We should subsidize mass transit. We should lower the speed limit. I mean, if you just simply lower the speed limit nationally to 55 miles an hour and people adhered to it, you would save approximately 1 billion gallons of gasoline a year from being burned. So it's really, to me, about educating people on how dire the situation is and having our leaders stop denying that it's happening and really face this thing head on, because the fossil fuel industry has bought and paid these politicians to do their bidding and to lie, which kind of goes back to the freedom of speech issue, which I think, all freedom of speech, that's great, but let's tell the truth.
All right. Thanks for that, Pam. Appreciate that. So that gets back to what you were talking about earlier, Kevin, where there needs to be one social approach in addition to the two geoengineering approaches, and the social approach is to reduce the use of fossil fuels now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I couldn't agree more that we need to cut back on our use of these fuels. The trouble is that, you know, we can't even get our politicians in the United States to work on that. How are we going to get them in India and China to work on that? You know, we could turn all our carbon off today, but we're not going to turn the rest of the world off. And, you know, it gives me a kind of a hopeless feeling when you think, you know, we cannot influence our politicians to do the right thing. How are we going to do it, you know, and I've seen people, you know, Africans are actually quite bad at looking after their environment, because what they're doing is they're trying to live, and that's their major concern. Not really the environment that they're living in. And there are a large number of people in this world that want to turn the light on, and they don't have the ability. If you look at the IEA, the International Energy Association Agency, there are 1.3 to 1.4 billion people that do not have access to electricity. And then there's a total of 2.7 billion people that don't have access to clean cooking fuels. And I couldn't find numbers on how many people do not have access to reliable electricity. A lot of the time that's because they're of lack of generation capacity, but it's going to be a large number. And so if it was just a matter of getting us in America to do the right thing, I would think that maybe we could do it without engineering the climate, because maybe eventually we could get through to our politicians and our movers and shakers to do it right. But I don't think, you know, if we can't do it in America, we can't do it with the rest of the world.
Interesting. So failure politically equals more intensity technologically.
Unfortunately, yes. You know, I don't see another way around this problem. You know, I've been thinking about this project, this subject, in that, you know, I think there's a lot of people in the world who deny climate change, who do not want to think about climate change. And one reason they don't want to think about it is because it's a hopeless case anyway. You know, I mean, how can we solve this problem? There are no ways of solving the problem. Therefore, I don't want to think about it, don't want to talk about it. And we'll just ignore the subject until, you know, doomsday. And, you know, that's one thing that I think if we could, you know, maybe say, okay, there's a little bit of hope. There's a glimmer of hope. There's a way we might be able to get around this problem, but we all need to work together to cut back on our emissions and then try these other techniques to you know, that will ameliorate the effects. Maybe some kind of hope can be generated. You know, but maybe that's also just pie in the sky.
Let's take another call. Here is Glenn in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with geologist Kevin Downing. We're talking about climate change and geoengineering to potentially forestall it.
Yeah, hi. I was also an exploration geologist. I worked in the third world. And all those 4 or 5 billion people, they want to live like we do. He's right. And the thing that kind of annoys me is that there's never any mention of population control. I think if people are really serious about confronting climate change, you have to address the population question. Because if we're going to add another 2 or 3 billion people in the next decade or two, that'll negate any sort of effort we make.
All right.
The point I'd like to make is that, you know, the percent of people who are accepting the problem of climate change is going down in our country. So I think the current way to try and convince them is not working. And what I always advocate is that, instead of citing this study or that study and that modeling experiment, you should just put it in the way of saying it's just an experiment with the atmosphere that we're doing. It's really not a smart idea, and we really can't be sure how it might turn out. Maybe good, maybe a disaster, but I think people would have a positive reaction if you presented it. It's just not a smart thing to be experimenting with the atmosphere.
All right. Thanks for that, Glenn. Appreciate it. On to Brad in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kevin Downing.
Yes, thank you for the show. I will be going next Tuesday night to hear him speak to the SOCAN group.
You'll be a week early. Go 2 weeks out. It's
2 weeks out.
Tuesday, January
27th. Thanks a lot, Jeffrey. I like his point that we already are geoengineering. We're putting 2.4 million pounds of carbon into the air per second, and our air is only about 7 miles thick. It's a singular air supply. And we're clogging it over and over again. When I go up to my wood pile and I carry an armful of wood in and burn my fire, I end up with a handful of ashes. Well, what happened to the rest of all that substance of that wood? It's in the air because it came from the air to create the plant to begin with. And the same thing when I see these huge gasoline trucks that go around with this sign on the side, 2308 or 2803 or something, all this gasoline. The whole volume of that truck is going to be in our air. When the trains go by with all these coal, miles and miles of coal in the train, all that stuff is going to be in our air. So we are geoengineering, and I'm reluctant to jump on a let's geoengineer back kind of a way of approaching it, because what we're doing is we're addicted, and we're thinking with the past. We're thinking with past technologies instead of potential future ones. And I would assert right now that this cheap gas that we're undergoing, this $2 a gallon business, is a deliberate. The world should thank the solar community and the wind community for that cheap gas, because I think it's a deliberate attempt to undermine the progress that is going on with solar and wind, and to cause people to go buy their big SUVs again and forget about solar on their rooftops and so forth. And it's going to set us back. It's almost like a perfect storm of exacerbating the climate crisis, when we already know, both in terms of heat and in terms of electricity, we can take all kinds of free, clean, ongoing energy out of the sunlight, out of the wind that's going by. All we need to do is invest in the jobs and the technologies to put those things in place, and we'll have all kinds of economic benefits. But because we don't do the ethical thing, we end up with an economic mess. And if we did an ethical thing, we would have a geological, economic solution to our whole thing. So I'm more in favor of alternative energy supply on the things we know do work. They don't solve everything, but they solve a lot that we're now wasting our skies by polluting them.
All right, Brad, thanks for the thoughts. Very much appreciate that. But he brings up some good points there, Kevin, one of which you can relate to as a geologist, which is the digging of things out of the ground and burning them. A lot of that goes into the air.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and I actually heat my house with wood rather than with electricity. And, you know, the way I look at it is that at least what I'm doing, because I'm burning trees that have already died, so they're eventually going to decompose and give off their carbon dioxide and methane. I'm accelerating that process, but at least I'm using carbon that is in the current cycle. It's in the current atmospheric cycle, rather than using carbon that came from coal 270 million years ago, or oil sometime 100 million years ago, or whatever, whenever the oil plants died and started generating their fuel for us. You know, it's what's in the current cycle, and that's the problem we have, is that we're introducing all this old stuff into our present cycle.
You know, the other point he brings up is the fact that when oil prices are as low as they are now, and they're about $100 lower than they were about, 2 years ago, it not only discourages exploration in fields not related to fossil fuels, but it even discourages exploration of fossil fuels themselves, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. I mean, you know, basically what, you know, one of the principal reasons that we have this low oil price right now is from the fracking revolution. You know, basically, if you go back 15 years, peak oil was going to be, you know, the time when production started to taper off, not keep growing. Peak oil was going to be, you know, sometime around now. But I haven't seen any recent estimates now on peak oil after the fracking revolution. I mean, that technology has really increased our ability to fry ourselves for a long time.
Let us take another call. Let's go to Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking global warming and atmospheric remedies for it with Dr. Kevin Downing.
Yeah, hi, Jeffrey and Kevin. And Kevin, I appreciate your concern. When you said what you said about people sticking their heads in the sand and not wanting to think about it, it reminded me that not that long ago on Jefferson Exchange, you were interviewing an author, Jeffrey, who wrote a book called Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change.
Uh-huh.
When I look at not just climate change, but almost every problem that humanity faces, they all seem to be rooted in how people think and how our brains actually function. And I think that if we're going to turn this thing around, we're going to have to influence people. We're going to have to come up with strategies that actually get people to think. And ignoring that and looking to solve everything through some technological means is, I think, exactly what's gotten us into this problem.
All right. Thanks, Sandy. Appreciate that. Thoughts, Kevin?
I can understand the point of view. You know, and he might well be right. You know, the thing is that, you know, I don't think we know what we do know what the answer is to turn off our use of carbon now. But we also know that that's not going to happen. And so, you know, what do we do? Do we just say, okay, you know, we in America, we will try in our own small way to help ourselves, but we know we're going to fail because they're not doing it in India, China, and Africa? Or do we try and think, well, you know, are there some alternatives out there, some things that we can try, at least do some research so that we can say, okay, you know, say like, well, you know, one of the main SRM techniques and the most controversial SRM technique is sulfate aerosols in the stratosphere. You know, when I first read about that, I thought, oh, I don't want to have anything to do with that. That does not sound good. But when you look at it, maybe there is a possibility that it could help us out in the short term before we can actually use CDR techniques to remove the carbon out of the atmosphere.
So a stopgap technique to get us a grip, get us a toehold so we can begin to push back against climate change. Much still to talk about, but not in this hour. Kevin Downing will be at the meeting of SOCAN, Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, Tuesday, January 27th at 6 at the Medford Library. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
All right, take care.